Last time on Appalachian Mysteria, the Parade of Horribles. We talked about some of the suspects in the girls' murders, showing that one of the problems investigating the case was that there were way too many of them. On this episode, a state trooper is fired after speaking out about the investigation. Governor Moore himself lashes out at the Dominion News. A lost form of media is explored, and we meet the man who was convicted of killing the girls, Eugene Paul Clausen. Listener discretion is advised. From Chromatic Media in the heart of Morgantown, West Virginia, this is Appalachian Mysteria, Season 1, The WVU Coed Murders. Before we dive headlong into the nearly two-episode finale of the show, which takes place 6 years after the disappearance of Merritt and Karen, I want to thank everyone, especially all the Morgantown residents who took the time to talk to us about this case. From our friends to the people we literally stopped at random to ask, everyone remembered something. You've all filled in little gaps in our knowledge and have made the story personal to us in a way that it wouldn't have been otherwise. Wherever we go, people have something to say about Merritt and Karen, about hitchhiking in 1970, about whether Eugene Clausen was guilty of the crime, even if what they have to say is not technically accurate.
They did think they found their bones once.
Uh-huh.
But it was happened over, I think it happened right around here somewhere. That was sad. And they couldn't find, never found the bodies, but they did think one time that they found the bones somewhere out in the country with that.
Well, I remember thinking how dreadful it was.
How old
I was
were
in
you?
High school then. I was still in high school.
They were students at WVU, is that
yes,
what it was?
Yes, they were. It was horrible. I mean, it was just a shocking, shocking thing.
Well, everybody was hitchhiking. Lots of people. My brothers, people only had one car. We had five kids, mom and dad, one car. Okay? So you'd tell her, I got a ride to Morgantown, but yet you would do this. So that was the culture. You didn't tell your parents you were hitchhiking, but you would do it. And all my brothers hitchhike back and forth for sports.
It's not allowed. It's not legal at that time. But I was under the impression the police really didn't enforce it. Do you remember it ever, like, anyone ever getting in trouble for it or anything like that?
No. Never.
We also received a great number of messages via Facebook and from the Chromatic Media webpage. Just before we start the final chapters of our story, here's a small sampling read by some of our friends and family, not voice actors, who just volunteered to help.
I know of a so-called man that has Polaroid pics that he said were of the girls when they found them, so he said. He supposedly was a VFD member that helped search. He is a perv himself. He'd show them to neighborhood girls and threaten them that they'd end up the same if they didn't perform certain sex favors for him.
Before they found the heads, there was a belief that they were buried under I-79. As I recall, I-79 was under construction at the time of the murders. There were several accounts by people who claimed they got chills as they hit the same spot of the 79 after it opened. When I was at Dominion Post, I was able to read the entire unedited police report of this crime. It was absolutely the most chilling reading I've ever done. The things those poor girls were put through, as someone once told me, there are worse things in life than death. After I read the report, I really wished I hadn't.
No heads were found. They were picked up by the book exchange on Willie Street. My guard unit, the 21st Battery, hunted for them. My friend and I had to wear fishing waders the next day to search streams nearby for heads. I will always remember this.
I was a student at WVU at the time, and like a lot of girls who did not have a car, used to hitchhike to the Med Center Library in the evening to study. Buses didn't run, and the PRT hadn't been constructed. One evening, a big black car stopped to pick up a friend and me, and the driver happened to be President Harlow, who drove us to the Med Center and lectured us all the way about the dangers of girls hitchhiking, especially after those gruesome murders. It was a frightening time for all women on campus.
This happened below where we live now. They call it Headless Hollow.
I remember this. We lived on Goshen Road, and my dad found a pair of girls' boots in a phone booth on the Grafton Road.
Every time I hear the song, Bridge Over Troubled Waters, I think of the co-eds. There was an all-day plea on either WAJR or WCLG for people to please check their property and outbuildings for any signs of the missing girls. They played that song all day during announcements. The bodies were found shortly after that, but not the heads. That was the creepiest time, to know that whoever did such a hideous thing was still out there.
Thanks to everyone who wrote us and spoke to us. this point, you know that the police were accused of ineptitude during this investigation. We've pointed out some ways that was probably the case, and also highlighted the rigorous police work that led to the identification of Triangle. We've shown that some leads were not followed up on, but also that there were so many suspects and angles to pursue that it would have been impossible to do so. The last word on authorities' handling of the case goes to State Trooper Preston Gooden. Preston Gooden was there from the beginning. He had been in Morgantown to look into the bombing of Lurita when the girls first disappeared. As the case developed, Gooden began to have serious problems with the handling of the investigation. Allegedly, he was the one who found Merritt's unprocessed purse just sitting on top of the filing cabinet, and he was the one who had only learned of the discovery of her glasses after he saw it on the evening news. He was intimately involved in the search for Merritt and Karen's killer.
He hadn't been a trooper a long time, but he had a lot of experience investigating crimes, and he had a lot of took a lot of courses. He was very well educated in federal, local, all sorts of procedure.
Sarah and Jeff say he was relatively young for someone in his position, only 31, but that he was sharp. He knew his shit. You could see his intelligence in the detail and narrative he put into his reports.
Gooden was stationed here. I'd gotten to know him through covering the police departments.
In case you don't recognize the voice, that's our first guest from episode 1, Evelyn Ryan, who was a reporter for the Dominion News at the time.
Gooden spoke before a group called the Combined Civic Club Committee, which was a group that formed itself as the result of the co-ed murders. And he was very outspoken in his criticism of the State Department of Public Safety, which was the overriding agency that controlled the state police. He said it was a system geared to the past, and he endorsed an open investigation of its operations, which of course was kind of like putting tinder to a fire. He cited 10 faults ranging from serious manpower to a system that permits officers to be transferred for doing their job. In his observation about the co-ed murders, "This case is not receiving priority. It frightens me to think a repeated co-ed crime may be a possibility, and until it is cleared, the possibility exists. Both cases may have been solved if we did not have constant interference from Charleston." He cited as the most direct interference the transfer of Sergeant Ariel Mozingo, who was head of the state police detachment, and several other troopers who had been with the case since its outset. So what happened was when the new investigators arrived, they were basically handling a cold case and all the issues there.
But the big bombshell in this speech came when he said, quote, "I have here documented proof that the Department of Public Safety and the executive administrator Norman Yost lied about the department's activities in the co-ed investigation," unquote.
Yost was the assistant to Governor Moore, and he had called, and Sergeant Harold answered the phone, and Yost asked him, "How good a liar are you?" And Harold answered, "Well, I'm the best you've ever seen. Why?" And he said, "Well, the Malarick family keeps calling, and they're going to come into Morgantown, and we need to tell them that we've had a 4-person investigation team on this the entire time." And Gooden was there, and he witnessed this, and he knew that that was not the case. Gooden said that this phone call happened on either the 10th or the 11th of April, which was right before the girls were found.
Oh, that early they were asked to lie.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know.
Because they still weren't taking it seriously at that point because the bodies hadn't been found.
Okay.
It almost goes unsaid that you can't get away with accusing your bosses of lying to a dead girl's parents in front of a civic club committee and get away with it. Gooden openly said he expected to be fired the next day, and he was.
Well, they finally announced in 2 months later exactly what they were charging him with. And it said, "Lessening public trust in the state police, hurting the morale of troopers, violating a regulation which says the policies cannot be made public for the good of the service, insubordination, and making unsubstantiated charges against the department."
After getting rid of Gooden, Governor Moore did his best to make sure that no other state police would testify against authorities publicly.
On May 11th, Governor Moore announced he'd make public the records of any trooper speaking before a closed-door committee, legislative committee. Some 13 troopers were to have appeared, but many said they refused at that point. So that shows you how far involved the governor was involved in that. he's not just controlling what information goes out, but he's also making veiled threats to anybody who attempted to speak out about what they saw.
Preston Gooden fought the charges, but was not reinstated to the force for 6 years because of the continued opposition of his superiors. When he was finally reinstated, he solved 4 cold cases in Beckley that had lingered unsolved in their files for years. And remember that this whole time, a public relations war continued to rage between the governor and the Dominion News.
Governor R.J. Moore Jr. Friday criticized news media handling of news of the search for bodies of the 2 slain West Virginia University co-eds and defended his management of information on the search. His comments came during an hour-and-a-half news conference, included criticism of individual newsmen, newspapers, and TV station, and the press in general. Quote, "I will confess I completely embargoed news, and if I had to do it again, I wouldn't change. I felt it was an act of common decency," unquote, to the parents. Quote, "Some of the ridiculous things that occurred in print," he said, indicated the Fourth Estate was, quote, "not at its finest hour." A Moore set of stories written to the effect that the superintendent was going to identify the headless bodies of the 2 co-eds by dental charts. I'm sorry, that was just too much to say with a straight face. He said the superintendent had discussed with the press possible ways of identifying the bodies prior to the time he knew the bodies were headless. Moore was harshly critical of the Morgantown Dominion News, although he did not use its name in the criticism. He said he believed the newspaper did not, quote, "want us to find the bodies. I think they were disappointed when we found them," unquote. He said the newspaper had been antagonistic to himself, the community it serves, to businesses, city police, state police, labor, and West Virginia University. Quote, "they have won trophies on a number of occasions. I don't know what they're for," unquote.
Good Lord.
Is this real life?
Over the years, the astounding number of suspects and leads dwindled in number.
They pretty much cleared all of them.
That's Dan Ringer, one of Clausen's defense attorneys.
And it had come to a dead end. And as police and governments do, they would say, oh, no, this is still an open investigation. Oh, no, we're still working hard on it. And when, in fact, it was all in boxes in the back room until Eugene Clausen essentially stood up and said, hey, look at me. And so the police said, sure, we don't have anybody else to look at. We'll look at you.
The first thing to understand about Eugene Paul Clausen was that he had a lot of things working against him early on in life.
Clausen was bisexual. At one point, he wanted to be a woman, and he wanted to have the operation, but his mother talked him out of it because she was afraid it would be too embarrassing. She lived in a small town. So instead, he took male hormone treatments to be more masculine.
Clausen's condition was a little different than others that appear often in public discourse. It wasn't just homosexuality, bisexuality, or transsexuality on their own. Clausen had Klinefelter syndrome. Most men inherit a single X chromosome from their mother and a single Y chromosome from their father. Men with Klinefelter syndrome inherit an extra X chromosome from one parent to the other. So instead of having a standard male karyotype XY, they are XXY.
So with Klinefelter syndrome, you either have full or mosaic. And if you have full Klinefelter syndrome, some of the symptoms are ADHD, breast enlargement, delayed puberty, flaccid muscles, infertility, small penis, and low libido. And Clausen described his physical attributes as having large breasts, and his testes were small like peanuts. He was suicidal. He tried to kill himself several times with pills, with knives. He was also in the military for a short time.
He was 6'2½, blue eyes, brown hair, 141 pounds, and Roman Catholic.
It's yet another kind of minority for him to belong to in Point Marion.
His physiological differences, which were made manifest both in his appearance and his behavior, led to abusive treatment by almost everyone in his life.
Clausen complained many times of how he had been raped and abused over and over again in Point Marion when he was growing up by the other kids. And probably his Kleinfelders made him look strange, and probably looked strange for a lot of reasons. But he was just abused by lots of people. He was beaten up regularly. At one point, under hypnosis, later he describes a pleasant memory of going with his mom to town and so forth, and she got him a pet rabbit, a white rabbit, and he brought it home, and he was really happy to have this pet rabbit, but he only had it a few days, and he was asked what happened to it, and my neighbor hit it in the head with an axe and killed it. So he was clearly on the outs in Point Marion, ostracized by lots of people. Apparently, when he was in grade school, he was made to sit in the back of the classroom so he wouldn't be disruptive, and he was ostracized by classmates and teachers. We've heard over the years from different people, and I think several places, both from people and I think in several reports, it described his being run out of town basically when he was about 16, and that's when he joined and ended up joining the military. It was during that period to have some focus to his life, I guess.
He said it was the happiest time in his life because he was so far away from Point Marion.
With all of that said, it is also important for us to be forthcoming about the fact that Eugene Clausen was no angel. He was not even an innocent person. He was, in fact, someone that a significant portion of the population might want locked away.
In 1958, he was convicted of stealing two separate vehicles. And he was sent to a reform school for about 15 months. He wasn't really charged with anything outside of burglary or larceny until about 1960, when he was charged with sodomizing an 11-year-old. And he was sent to the Pittsburgh Penitentiary. He got out really quickly, and I'm not sure why. I don't know why these charges didn't hold more weight back then. But in 63, he was picked up again for sodomy and buggery. This time it was a female. In 73, he was picked up again for a homosexual offense with a minor, and they only kept him for 1 month. So in 73, he was picked up again, this time for carnal abuse of a 13-year-old female. And he actually stayed 1 year in prison for this one.
While incarcerated in Camden, New Jersey, waiting to be sentenced for his latest conviction, one of his fellow inmates, Felton Harp, contacted authorities, saying Clausen had confessed to killing Merritt and Karen.
On January 9th, Felton Harp spoke to authorities in New Jersey and said that the certain cellmate, Eugene Paul Clausen, had been having nightmares for months and had finally confessed to Felton Harp that he had killed two girls down in West Virginia and cut off their heads, and it was getting to his conscience and he was having nightmares.
Four days later, two state troopers and a Morgantown detective drove up to Camden, New Jersey, where they interviewed three people: Clausen, Felton Harp, who had reported him, and another inmate named Glass, who had supposedly also heard Clausen's confession. The officers met with Harp first, and he told them this story. When Merritt and Karen disappeared, Clausen was working in Philadelphia. That Sunday, he got off work in the afternoon and drove his car 300 miles west to Point Marion, where he grew up. He left the car at his mother's house and hitchhiked to Pittsburgh, 65 miles north. There, he stole a different car and drove back in the direction he'd just come from, 75 miles south, to Morgantown. He picked up Merritt and Karen downtown and forced them to perform sex acts at gunpoint in the car, some of which would be considered on the fringes of sexuality if done consensually. Then he drove them to a remote area, shot them both in the head, and decapitated them with his brother's machete. After having sex with their heads in the back of the car, which is as hard for me to say out loud as it is for you to hear it, he returned to Point Marion. Finally, he abandoned the stolen car.
And they said, oh, you know, this is all very good. Thank you, Mr. Harp. Would you continue to help us out? And he said, sure, he would do that. And he said, well, we want to give you three questions. Before we talk to him, we want you to get answers to these questions. And so find out if Clausen, what he did with the heads, if he took anything from the girls, like anything, you know, clothing, different items, and where the machete and the firearm are now. So they sit and wait or do whatever they do. And about 6 o'clock, Harp gets back to them and says, yes, I got your answers. He threw the heads in a crevice on Con Hill. It's an old school near Point Marion. He also threw the gun in there. And he got the machete from his brother. So he had washed that off, cleaned it with gasoline and put it back where he got it. And as far as taking things, he took some kind of necklace thing, a class ring, and a watch.
Karen had often worn a chain around her neck. A month before she disappeared, she had put her class ring on that necklace. It had not been found with her body. With answers to these three questions, they interviewed Glass, who basically told them the same thing. Then they interviewed Clausen.
When they compared these statements, they were heartened by the fact that Clausen's differed slightly from Harp's and Glass's. Those were close to the same. Glass and Harp's, for instance, said that the car he was driving was light blue. Clausen said it was cream-colored. Now, witnesses said it was a cream-colored or light car. Well, they didn't say blue. So they felt that Clausen was more correct and therefore more likely to have actually been the killer. The other thing was that Harp and Glass both said that Clausen picked him up outside of a movie. And when Clausen was asked about that, he said, not where I picked them up wasn't no movie. And actually where Meredith and Karen were picked up was a block and a half away from the movie theater. There's no reason that anyone would have connected it to a movie. Those two discrepancies suggested to investigators that Clausen had in fact committed the crimes and that Harp and Glass simply messed up what Clausen said.
The troopers and the detective stayed the night in Camden. Before heading back to Morgantown, they agreed to first drive to Con Hill in Pennsylvania, the area where Clausen said he threw Merritt and Karen's heads. It was an old schoolyard in an area where there were several abandoned mine entrances, and Clausen had described one particular hole or crevasse he'd thrown the heads into. They couldn't seem to find it.
So they called him on the phone and said, got any better directions? Because we're not finding this thing. So he gave them better directions. They taped it so that they could follow his explicit directions. They taped it, and they determined that they were going to have to get some people up here, many people, to come up, start searching for the holes, because there were holes all over the place there. They had all these searches up there, and they managed to get 40 feet down underground, and then they decided it was too dangerous to keep pushing and get deeper. And then they sent a special camera down because they couldn't have people down there. So they were searching off and on for about a month, and there was snow, too much snow, and they'd have to call off for a couple days. And then, you know, so they were searching off and on throughout most of February.
The month-long search did not leave authorities with Merritt and Karen's heads, but it did leave them with one of the only things that would be submitted as physical evidence in Clausen's trial. Nestled in one of the holes was an animal nest made of brush and leaves and 120 human hairs. The hairs were not pulled out by the root, but rather had been cut. In Clausen's trials, which we will go into, the defense presented the case that it would not have been surprising to find hairs in an animal nest there. They claimed that someone who regularly cut hair in her house lived nearby. They almost made her out to be an amateur hairdresser, but Sarah found her less than 2 weeks ago. She said that the police only contacted her because her family had a Jeep, and they had commandeered it to drive up on Con Hill to look for the heads. She doesn't know how the defense found out that she cut her family's hair. She said the police had actually brought her the hairs, and that she told them that she hadn't cut them because no one in her family had hair that long. She said she was a neighbor to Clausen's brother, James, who owned the machete that Clausen supposedly used to decapitate the girls. She believes Clausen did it. She told Sarah that she'd be happy to talk with us on the record about this. Since that time, all three of us have left messages. We can no longer reach her. About 3 weeks after he first confessed, New Jersey authorities agreed to administer a polygraph test to Clausen about the co-eds. They kept it short and sweet.
So the polygraph that he took in New Jersey was on January 27th, and they basically asked him three things. Did you kill the co-eds? Yes. Did you throw their heads in Con Hill? Yes. Did you take their jewelry? Yes. And they deemed him completely truthful, that he was not lying.
Presumably, they also asked the baseline questions that are typically asked first during a polygraph test, but these were not recorded. I asked Sarah if she knew why there had only been three questions.
Sure. New Jersey authorities really didn't have any reason to care if he had done the crimes because they would have taken place in West Virginia. It wasn't in their jurisdiction. They were more concerned about getting him to say on tape that he had killed someone because they were interested in five other murders and they wanted to question him about those that happened in New Jersey.
Meanwhile, West Virginia police were still following up on other parts of Clausen's confession. He claimed to have stolen a car in Pittsburgh the day he picked up Merritt and Karen, so they called Pittsburgh police to see whether any stolen cars had been reported. There had been exactly one. The next few minutes are going to seem like a detour at first, but I promise you they will soon become very relevant to our story. So if you've made it this far in the Merritt and Karen podcast, I figure there's one of two things that are probably true about you, maybe both. Number one, you're from the region and you like local history. Maybe you grew up in West Virginia, maybe you went to school at WVU in Morgantown, or maybe you just live somewhere in Appalachia and like hearing stories about your cultural and geographical region. Or number two, you like true crime. This podcast is just one manifestation of a true crime resurgence that has happened over the past several years. We had Making a Murderer on Netflix, The Jinx on HBO, Serial, which is almost certainly the most listened to true crime podcast ever. While the genre of true crime is on an upswing in modern media forms, it had its first successful manifestation in a media form that no longer even exists, the Detective Magazine.
I've always been very interested in true detective magazines ever since I was very young. I'd see them on the newsstands. I couldn't afford to buy them, but you know, I was looking at these things in the 70s on the newsstands and just being absolutely flabbergasted at the violent covers.
This is John Marr. He's the creator of the zine Murder Can Be Fun, which is well known in circles of people with this particular set of interests. He created the zine back in 1986. In one way, it succeeded at what we're trying to do here, combining the careful research of terrible events with entertaining storytelling. Murder Can Be Fun is preserved in the zine collection at the University of Iowa and the San Diego State University Library. He has a healthy knowledge of true crime from this era, including detective magazines.
I wrote some articles about true detective magazines just because it was such a off-the-wall topic, as they'd completely vanished from the urban mind. I mean, they were just only sold in like rural areas and like Greyhound bus stations by the 80s. And then, of course, they went away, and I like to say I was the only person who noticed that True Detective magazine actually stopped publishing.
While researching for this episode, I found one of John's articles that he wrote for Gizmodo titled The Long Life and Quiet Death of True Detective Magazine. He seemed like the perfect person to help me explain the genre.
You know, True Detective Mysteries was a very, just a staple of newsstands. I mean, millions of people read these things. I think True Detective was selling a million copies every month. And then in the 60s, interest changed. The magazines became seen as, you know, much less respectable, didn't really fit into the optimistic tenor of the times, I guess. And the larger, more respectable publishers got out of the field and sold to smaller outfits that specialized in more exploitative approach to the genre, with a very, very much of an emphasis on shocking material, you know, very shocking covers.
When I was first looking over the images of covers from this era, something that I noticed fairly quickly was that you would not see covers like this on newsstand shelves today. For second wave feminists of the time, they were outrageous.
The covers specialized in violence against women. It was always like the woman was either like bound, about to be shot, about to be stabbed, about to be sexually assaulted, and they always had a look of terror on their face, and there'd frequently be the luring perpetrator. Some of the images appeared to be torture, which kind of makes them a very popular collectible of all things. And in the 80s, they reversed it, and all the covers were like the woman victim turning the tables on the perpetrator, like grabbing the gun or grabbing the knife. So they tried to still be salacious, but in a more like socially acceptable manner.
John says that despite the salacious covers, the stories themselves always tended to focus on the narrative of police work.
The emphasis on these things was on the solved crime and following the police through the step-by-step process to capture the criminals. I mean, there weren't very many stories about unsolved crimes for various reasons.
But there were a few exceptions, which brings me to why we're talking about detective magazines in the first place. Between the time police first visited Clausen in New Jersey and the day his trial started, Clausen left no room to wonder whether he had committed the crime.
Clausen really, really tried hard to convince people that he did it. I don't remember exactly how many times it was, but I counted a couple of dozen statements that he made that were consistent with his confession and reiterated things about it. He would be in the police car driving to West Virginia when he was being transported. And he would say, that's where I picked the girls up. I turned down that street to take them wherever. And each one of those is a confession to some part of the crime. And there were a couple of dozen of those.
But before his trial could begin, Clausen suddenly recanted his confessions. All of them. The entire story, he said, had been stolen from a detective magazine. As the trial began, the lead prosecutor in the case, David Solomon, gave opening arguments that read like a fire and brimstone sermon. Portions of it went something like this.
Now, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I will now open the evil window of death and relate to you what facts and circumstances a state of West Virginia will rely upon to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Eugene Paul Clausen is guilty of the premeditated and willful murder of two young girls on Sunday night, January 18th, 1970, in the lonely and silent woods of Monongalia County. The evil window of death will show that the defendant murdered these two coeds in cold blood, after perpetrating upon their bodies every abuse and indignity that could be perpetrated upon a human being and to which a human being could be subjected to. How long this continued, we cannot be sure. Apparently, several hours were consumed in these preliminaries of death to satisfy this defendant before his final and ultimate act of the decapitation of these young ladies, as even in his murder of these two ladies, an ignoble and humiliating means of death, was to be employed. I want your verdict of guilty of murder in the first degree to resound throughout the length and breadth of Monongalia County. I ask God that he gives you the wisdom and the strength to return the right verdict. Not guilty means Mr. Clausen walks out of this courtroom a free man. Paul Clausen, I charge you with the evil murders of two co-eds and for your moral debasements. And you deserve to spend the rest of your life in prison, away from decent people.
The small portion of Clausen's case that we've just discussed is as guilty as we can make him seem. We tried our best. Next episode, the state mounts the most expensive prosecution in its history, even as its foundations begin to deteriorate. But will that even matter for the verdict? We review the detective article on which Clausen supposedly based his confessions, attempt to determine the motives of his supposed accomplice in the story, Felton Harp. The case goes to the West Virginia Supreme Court, and then goes to trial again.
Some would describe it as the case of a lifetime. I'd been in practice for about 2 years, maybe three, when this happened. And everything since then has been a kind of anticlimactic. And I've had some real interesting cases over the years. Lord, the Clausen case, or the co-ed murder case, they call it, was pretty much a high point.
Special thanks to John Marr of Murder Can Be Fun for talking with us about detective magazines, and thanks to Patrick Connor for voicing Solomon's opening statements. You can find Chromatic Media and the WVU Coed Murders on Facebook and at coedmurders.com. If you enjoyed the show, take 2 seconds to rate it on your favorite podcasting service to help other listeners find good stuff. Season 1 of Appalachian Mysteria is produced by myself and Sarah Gibbons, with lots of assistance by Jeff Fuller. Our theme song was written and recorded by Nick Larson, John Smithers, Annie Stroud, and Nathan Snyder. We only had 2 guest tracks from other Morgantown musicians today. First, there was Dog and Gun with their 10-mile interlude. And Ordo Templi Sonica with Silver Gate. Stay tuned, folks.